everybody, and welcome back to the Teach Me to Code podcast. This is your host, Charles Max Wood, and this week I'm going to be playing an interview that I did with Josh Berkus. For those of you who don't know who he is a database aficionado, I guess. He is a member of the core team, the Postgres core team, or PostgreSQL is how he explained it's pronounced. Anyway, so we talked a lot about Postgres, MySQL, relational databases, and a whole bunch of stuff. Now, funny thing happened when we were talking. We did the entire interview. It took about 50 minutes. We wrapped it up, cut it off, and, you know, I said thank you and goodbye and all that stuff. And then we were chatting a little bit afterward, and I hit the record button just a few minutes in because he said, well, I'm a little surprised you didn't ask me about non-relational databases. And I was like, well, I was going to ask you about that, but the interview was going a little bit long, and so I wanted to wrap it up. And he said, and so we started talking again, and we talked for another 50 minutes. And I recorded all but like the first minute and a half of that. So this week and next week are going to be Josh Berkus episodes, and it was just awesome. Stuff that I never really thought about with databases there. So if you are looking to learn that stuff, then by all means, stick with it and listen to this week and next week. One other thing that I want to go over, this podcast is sponsored by New Relic. New Relic is an online application management tool. It is a super way of keeping tabs on what's going on in your application. It keeps track of things like your AppDeck score, errors that are going on, and things like that. And it's just a super way to not only keep your finger on the pulse of your app, but to track down problems and slow down. So go check them out at newrelic.com. Just let them know that we sent you over there from teachmetocode.com. Finally, I do want to also point out that there are a lot of things going on and a lot of things coming up. I have also neglected my mailing list. So if you've signed up for the mailing list, be aware that I'm probably going to get something out this weekend or next week. And if you haven't signed up for the mailing list, go to teachmetocode.com and sign up. Otherwise, you can also just get a hold of me, Chuck at teachmetocode.com or on Twitter at cmaxw. Anyway, I'm going to go ahead and play the interview, and we'll pick you up on the other side. Hey, everybody. This is Charles Maxwood with Teach Me to Code. And this week, I'm going to be talking with Josh Berkus. Josh is a member of the Postgres SQL core team. And I know I probably said that wrong, but welcome to the podcast, Josh.
Thank you. We've learned to live with having a difficult to pronounce database name. The correct pronunciation is actually PostgreSQL. Okay. But almost nobody guesses that off the bat, which is why most people say Postgres. Unless you're in South America, in which case they say Postgre.
Huh. Interesting. So why don't you go ahead and tell us a little bit about yourself, and then we'll start talking about PostgreSQL.
Okay. I'm on the core team of PostgreSQL, which is a currently 7-member steering committee for the project that mostly sets release dates and arbitrates disputes in the community. I've been on the core team since 2003. I've been working on Postgres since 1998. Starting with version 6.5. I'm also president of a consulting company, PostgreSQL Experts Incorporated, where we do sort of hands-on development, performance, troubleshooting, et cetera, for companies these days for things which are inclusively Postgres. That is, all of our clients use Postgres. Uh-huh. But we often end up getting involved with things like Solr and Redis and CouchDB and Memcache and Django as well. Sorry, oh. Django.
There you go. I mispronounce your technology, so you'll mispronounce someone else's.
Yeah.
All right. So you've been on the core team since 2003. Now, how did PostgreSQL get started?
PostgreSQL is a University of California, Berkeley project, like many open source projects that we know, actually. So like FreeBSD, like Berkeley DB, And it started out as Michael Stonebreaker's second relational database project.
Mm-hmm.
So he and his team of graduate students created Ingress back in 83, I believe.
Okay.
And they basically sold it to a commercial company. There's more to it than that, but they basically sold it to a commercial company. And then he went back to actually create a relational database that was going to be the next generation beyond Ingress, which is why it was called Postgres.
Right.
And that was 1986. So the project is actually now 25 years old. It was a purely university project called Postgres until 1995, at which point the database department of Cal sort of lost interest in relational databases, and as a result, they kicked it off campus. But at that point, it already had some production users outside the university, one of whom was, at the time, one of the leaders of the FreeBSD project. And so he turned it into an he and a group of four other people turned it into an open source project.
Okay. That's really interesting. And so it's kind of... it's kind of stayed independent since. It seems like there are a lot of SQL implementations that are tied to other companies like Oracle and MySQL, which is tied to Oracle. And so this one, it doesn't seem to be deeply connected to any one corporation or company.
No, it's we're what's called a community project. So like probably the most similar project out there is Linux.
Uh-huh.
Where not only is the project itself, does it not belong to one company, but also it doesn't even belong to one nonprofit. I mean, Apache is also a community project, uh-huh. but there's this central nonprofit organization that manages and controls all of the Apache stuff.
Right.
Whereas with Postgres, we have, I think, about five different nonprofits, but they're all sort of strictly regional. The actual leadership of the project is unincorporated and independent of you know, both for-profit and nonprofit corporations.
Oh, interesting. So why do you think that works out maybe better than the Apache model or the MySQL model?
Well, in the case of the MySQL model, I think the reason it works out better is nobody can buy us.
Right.
I mean, that's ultimately has been what has landed MySQL in trouble right now, is a combination of VC money and buyouts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as for the Apache model, I don't know that you could say the Apache model isn't working.
Right.
We just sort of predate that model. And once you have an established leadership structure that works without having a nonprofit incorporation, then there isn't really a reason to create one.
Right. That makes sense. So so who are the other... So you... One thing that comes to mind real quickly is you mentioned that the core team is kind of a steering committee. Does that mean that you guys are not the developers?
Well, no, some of the lead developers are on the core team, but not all of the lead developers are on the core team. Like, if you look at the people who write the largest amount of code for the core database engine,
mm-hmm.
Tom Lane is obviously number one, and he's on the core team. But Robert Haas and Simon Riggs for like this year would be number two and number three. I don't know in what order.
Mm-hmm.
And neither of them are on the core team.
Okay.
So, yeah. So it's not, I mean, some of us are actually on the core team specifically actually for non-coding reasons. Like the main reason I'm on the core team is that I actually handle all of the public and corporate relations for the project.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I do work on large database stuff as well, so data warehousing features and that sort of thing.
Uh-huh.
But that wasn't the reason to include me on the core team.
Right.
You know, the same thing. We've got somebody who's on the core team. We've got like Dave Page and Magnus sort of share responsibilities for the web stuff, uh-huh. and that's the main reason to have them on the core team. So it's more of a way to oversee the whole project, not just the code.
That makes sense. That makes a lot of sense. It's. I guess I'm coming from kind of the Ruby on Rails standpoint, where generally when we're talking about the core team, we're talking about the core developers. Where, you know, the 37 Signals kind of manages the rest of that you've talked about, and you know, it's kind of an interesting thing. It seems to work for that project, but you know, it is a different approach, and you know, I can definitely see why you would want to do that. Do you feel that there are other advantages to having it community run versus being corporate backed, other than just, you know, we can't be bought?
Yeah, well, I mean, the we can't be bought goes further in that, like Linux, PostgreSQL is effectively community property. Mm-hmm. So companies that are ostensible competitors can still contribute to PostgreSQL. And can still draw use out of it in much the same way that people have with Linux. The other thing is that there isn't this dichotomy between the community and whoever owns the project. Anytime you set up a corporate structure, even in some cases a nonprofit, you develop this dichotomy between people who are officially members of the corporation and people who are not. Right. If it's a for-profit corporation, there's a definite tension between the staff of the corporation and the outside community. And cases where the company may want to take the project in directions that the majority of the community does not approve of. Mm-hmm. That was definitely the case with MySQL.
Right. Well, and we've seen Oracle do that with other projects, like Hudson is the one that keeps coming up in the circles that I move in.
Right. And the thing is that if Sun had pushed that out and turned over everything, including the name, to the community, rather than waiting to be bought out by Oracle, that whole problem would not have occurred.
Right. Okay. I'm going to move into a little bit more of maybe the technical things, and I don't know if you have the answers to this or not, but what seems to be the hardest part of building a database engine like Postgres or PostgreSQL?
What was the hardest part, or what's the hardest part today?
Let's start with what was the hardest part.
So the hardest part for us was actually... originally, the hardest part was actually getting something stable and reliable.
Mm-hmm.
That was what we focused on first. If you look at all the 5 years of development between 1995 and 2000, the first big part was porting it to SQL.
Right.
Because previously it had a proprietary query language. And then the second biggest part was just making it not crash. And keep in mind that we were doing this at a time when GCC and Linux were not that stable.
Mm-hmm. So it's written in C?
Yes.
Okay.
I would say actually let me back up. Let's go more meta here. The hardest part is actually finding people who understand database engines well enough to contribute to them.
I'll buy that.
And you talk to anybody in any database project, you know, SQL, non-relational, anything like that, they will always tell you that they could really use more database hackers.
Yeah, I'll bet. So I'm also a little curious, and this isn't one of the questions that I told you I'd ask, but why SQL over maybe some other query language?
Well, because SQL is actually the only standardized query language we have. It definitely has flaws,
mm-hmm.
But it has some major strengths. It's declarative, and the fact that it's a declarative language can be hard for a lot of people who are coming from object-oriented or procedural languages to wrap their head around.
Uh-huh.
But the declarative approach has a lot of advantages when it comes to handling data, because, you know, a declarative program set doesn't say do this, do that, do this other thing. It says give me this.
Right.
And the advantage of that is it allows you to separate the optimization. It allows you to separate the execution of the program from the semantics of the program.
Right. Okay.
And the thing is, because it is a standard, and we're really seeing this with today's new non-relational databases, is if you want to port your application from CouchDB to MongoDB, that's extremely painful. You probably have to rewrite the thing from scratch. Whereas porting a program from one SQL database to another will involve a refactoring thing, but the refactoring job involves rewriting, say, 10% of your code,
right?
Not most of the project.
Right, and that's because projects like MySQL have actually added things to the SQL standard, and you have to work around those when you port to PostgreSQL?
All SQL databases have. I mean, there's two different things you get with the standard. One is you get databases that don't support certain aspects of the standard. And the two major ones that are particularly chronic in this respect are MySQL. Although they've gotten much better since 5. Mm-hmm. And Microsoft SQL Server. Mm. And then the other end of things that you have is you have extensions to the standard. Because there's a fair separation between the standards committee and the people who are actually innovating in the database space. Mm-hmm. And so as a result, more sort of innovative features often end up not being covered by the standard or end up being covered by the standard badly.
Right.
Things like XML support, like spatial support, like handling of arrays, that sort of thing.
Uh-huh. Now, I understand that the PostgreSQL actually has some XML support. Is that then above and beyond what the standard is?
We're implementing part of the standard. I mean, part of the problem is that the standard is something called SQL XML, and it's a mess.
Right.
So we implemented it. Peter Eisentrout, actually, who's another member of the core team, implemented it as best as he could. According to the standard, well, with him and a Google Summer of Code student. Actually, we've got a second one working on it now, and I'm sorry, I don't remember the students' names off the top of my head. The implemented as best that he could, in that if you actually look at the standard, you realize it has contradictory portions where you can't possibly implement all of it. But the basic idea is that it's actually what we have now is currently pretty much completely within the standard.
Mm-hmm.
We currently have a Google Summer of Code project going on for XML indexing that does plan to implement some XPath support stuff that is beyond what the standard asks for. Mm-hmm. And we'll see whether or not that project gets completed and delivers something production worthy.
Okay. So what are some of the other extra standard features that you have in PostgreSQL?
Yeah, well, one of the ones that actually I know Ruby programmers at least should be interested in, and driver support is always sort of an issue here. We have a lot of extra data types. One of the things that was a tenet of the Postgres project from day one was this concept called object relational databases.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a lot of different ideas around that, some of which, like table inheritance, actually turned out to be fairly bad ideas. It wasn't something anybody could tell before they actually implemented one.
Right.
But there's a bunch of other ideas, such as the extensibility of database types, that turned out to be incredibly useful. One of the ones that I actually give is, you're implementing an inventory control database. Postgres actually has an optional ISN, ISBN data type that validates that kind of data and is actually structured to store that kind of data. And you can perform operations like checksums in it because it's built-in functions.
Huh.
So now, in the more generally useful department, Postgres array data types go well beyond the standard for collections in the SQL standard in terms of things that you can do with them. Doing the basic things with arrays that you would do in, say, Ruby, which is doing slices of arrays, adding, appending, and removing things from arrays. The ability to aggregate a column up into an array, even an ordered array, becomes extremely useful for pushing things in and out of, say, an object-oriented language. And then a whole assortment of other things. HStores, which is basically sort of a dictionary or hash concept. Full text search. One of the recent ones that's actually gotten some attention because of one of our features for 9.1 is trigrams, which is a special structured text that allows you to do fuzzy text matching.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, say you were searching for my name, Birkus, but you also wanted B-I-R-K-U-S to come up and B-I-R-K-I-S and other sort of minor spelling variants. Trigram can actually allow you to do that in an indexed way,
That's awesome. That's amazing. So is the full text search, I have to admit that I've been pretty lazy and I started out with MySQL and that's kind of what I've been using since. But... I know that the text search in there, you know, isn't... if I have like a longer set of text, if I have a text or long text or something, it won't index the whole thing. It'll index part of it, and I can I can then do fuzzy searching on part of it. Are you telling me that Postgres will allow me to search the entire field?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, honestly, I don't know too many people who use MySQL's built-in full-text search in production. You're one of the few that I've met. Most of the people that I know who are working on MySQL use Sphinx or export the whole thing to Lucene. So Postgres's full-text search, think of it as sort of a lightweight Lucene.
Okay.
You know, in terms of it, it not only indexes the entire field, and unlike at least MySQL up through the not yet released 5.6, it's transactional.
Right.
But it actually, if you want to get into the API for full-text search, supports a whole bunch of customization and sort of advanced search features like you'd be used to from a dedicated full-text search engine. So ranking, weighting of different words, weighting of different sections of the text, custom stop words, that is words that are excluded from indexing, because it originated around the creation of one of the primary Russian search engines. It also already comes out of the box with the ability to, for example, exclude HTML tags.
Wow.
So.
That is awesome. That right there may be enough for me to just go ahead and switch.
Okay.
So I'm a little curious then, what reasons do you usually see people switching from MySQL to PostgreSQL?
There's a variety of reasons. One is actually performance. Because since about 2006, 2007, Postgres has actually had the edge over MySQL and performance on a well-tuned application.
Okay.
Now, in a badly tuned application, it really depends on which soft spots you're hitting on which database. Because there are certain behaviors that will make Postgres perform terribly, and there are certain behaviors that will make MySQL perform terribly.
Right.
But for an application where you're going to have a DBA in, whether it's a MySQL DBA or Postgres DBA in, to actually tune the database and that sort of thing, for most releases, and there's a little bit of jockeying here, Postgres has slightly outperformed MySQL in terms of sort of general query throughput. That's a small thing. A bigger thing is reliability, in that just partly because of where we are in the database market and our history, Postgres is actually the most reliable SQL database out there.
Now, reliable in what way? In availability, or
if something goes wrong with your machine, your chances of recovering your database and being back up and running quickly are better with Postgres than they are with any other SQL database.
Okay.
And I mean, there's a cost to this. For example, we do, I think, 3 times as much transaction logging as any other database out there. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that is, you know, which has an imposes an IO cost. It uses IO resources in your system, which you really notice if you're running on Amazon. Mm-hmm. But it, you know, it has that advantage. And, you know, so we see a certain amount of migrations from MySQL after people had a really, you know, destructive crash and unrecoverable database issue. Other reasons are adoption of specific features.
Mm-hmm.
And mind you, that's a reason to go the other way. MySQL has all these custom storage engines that have special features. But Postgres has a bunch of features that MySQL doesn't have also. Probably a few more than going the other way. And as a result, you know, people who want, for example, the more advanced but still transactional full text search, people who want some of these special data types, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
A more common reason is the ability to support really complex queries.
Okay.
I mean, I do stuff in Postgres because, like, I mostly work on data warehousing stuff. And so as a result, I'm used to dealing with queries that will involve, say, 40 tables. And could be 200 lines long. And in my experience, those simply don't run on MySQL. you know, the, so, That's a reason. Now, lately, one of the other things that's emerged is a completely different reason, which is that people are really worried about the future of MySQL. Mm-hmm. And so we're seeing a lot of people who are adopting Postgres simply because they're basically database agnostic, mm-hmm. and they're concerned about what's going to happen to MySQL in the future, and Postgres now seems like a safer bet to them.
And that makes a lot of sense, and that's where a lot of the people that I've been talking to are coming from, where, you know, I talk a lot to people on Ruby on Rails, and generally, you know, because we are using an active relation or an object relational model, an ORM, it hides a lot of the features and details from you, and so they are basically agnostic, but they take a look at MySQL, they see some of the antics that Oracle has pulled with other projects, and they start to worry, and so they switch.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's the big thing. We were at, I was speaking at MySQL Conf this spring. Mm-hmm. And like normally at that conference, I'm used to getting, the primary question I'm used to getting, as you might imagine, is what's the difference between Postgres and MySQL? Mm-hmm. You know, to which my answer is, okay, well, do you have half an hour? Because it's a very detailed answer. But this year, the primary question was, where is Postgres going to be in 5 years?
Right.
You know, which my answer is, we're still going to be here. We're still, there's a lot more people involved, but we're still essentially the same project that we were in 1996.
Right.
And there's no reason to believe that we're going away or going to go off in some really bizarre direction that leaves most of our users behind.
Right. So what is the largest Postgres cluster that you've heard of running out there?
The largest one that I have numbers for would be Skype.
Skype, really?
So Skype uses the SkyTools clustering platform that they wrote, uh-huh. and that a number of other places use now. Okay. And I think for the stuff that keeps track of everybody's contacts, they have something like 200 Postgres servers.
Okay.
Now, given their growth rates, I bet Heroku will actually pass them up. Uh-huh. Within a couple of years, if Heroku keeps growing the way that they have been growing. But right now, I think Heroku is still only a couple of is. I don't remember the exact numbers, but I remember it was less than 100.
Huh. Interesting. Yeah, Heroku is kind of an interesting animal in the space that I work in, because I mean, they do the hosting and they provide you with the database, but you know, I guess it's not the level of control that I'm used to as a former sysadmin, but at the same time, you know, it does a lot of that automatic stuff. How much have you interacted with Heroku? Because it came up in our emails as well.
Yeah. Well, the thing is that Heroku's hosted a couple of events for the San Francisco PostgreSQL user group.
Okay.
And they've sponsored some other stuff, and we've dealt with them on some of the clustering things, because obviously they have a lot of issues or a lot to say about PostgreSQL replication and clustering. Uh-huh. You know, because they're really in the thick of it in terms of supporting their set of users.
Right.
They're not a professional client of mine, mm-hmm. Personally, but their engineers have been involved in the Postgres community.
Right. That makes sense. So I have to ask then, what is the difference between MySQL and PostgreSQL? I mean, we've talked about some of them. Is there anything else that you usually bring up that we haven't talked about?
Well, a lot of it is, I mean, you can actually sort of understand it in general if you understand that MySQL was originally built to please web developers.
Uh-huh.
I mean, originally, you know, sort of back, we're talking late 90s here.
Okay.
It was when they switched it from being a data warehousing startup, which was Monty's original idea, mm-hmm. Which was not that successful. And I realized the opportunity and switched it is that there was a lot of focus on implementing things that were the direct result of demands by, at the time, PHP and mod CGI developers. Postgres, if you look at Postgres, it was actually developed by people who were professional DBAs. So the original database was designed to please people who actually really liked relational databases. Mm-hmm. It was actually, I mean, that's why I was working on it, because when I got involved with it in 1998, you couldn't use it for anything production. I got it because at the time I was a Microsoft SQL Server consultant, and I was really frustrated with SQL Server's shortcomings. Mm-hmm. Wanted to do better. Now, there's been, as the markets broaden, there's been a lot of convergence, but you really start to understand this when you look at how new features are introduced. Because in the Postgres world, somebody can introduce a feature that would be really nifty in terms of usability, but if we can't make it reliable, then it'll get vetoed. Whereas historically, the MySQL approach has been more, let's adopt the feature and figure out a way to make it reliable later. which sometimes works better than other times. Mm-hmm. And pretty much most of the major differences between the two databases kind of devolve from those two different start points. Overall, I would say, one of the reasons to use Postgres doesn't really apply to Rails developers in that Postgres is an excellent database for when you want to really do things inside the database engine. Mm-hmm. When you want to take part of your code and run your code inside the database engine instead of outside the database engine. Right. And Postgres does support running a wide variety of programming languages inside the database. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, I don't believe that PL Ruby is what we call a fully supported stored procedure language, in that there are some things you can't do with it inside the database that you can do with Perl and Python.
Right.
But if somebody is really interested with that, it is an open source project. Somebody could complete the rest of the API. And you can certainly do some things. That doesn't really apply when you're using Rails, because you can interface with the database through an ORM.
Right.
So then the main other differences become, for somebody using Rails is MySQL is obviously the default database for Rails. It was mm-hmm. the database that Rails was originally built around.
Yep.
And as a result, a lot of the assumptions in the Rails ORM of how to interact with the database are based on actually what MySQL did.
Right.
On the other hand, Postgres has significant advantages both in reliability and security, mm-hmm. That can make it worth making the switch for a bunch of applications. It's really nice. I mean, I have another project that I work on that I can't name, but it actually involves five different database systems. And an awful lot of stuff gets stashed in Postgres because Postgres is the one database in that whole set that just never goes down. So if they need a place to put data, metadata that they're going to check when one of the other databases goes down, it goes in Postgres. Mm-hmm. And I think that's actually a big reason for adopting Postgres in places like Heroku is mm-hmm. that, it lowers their administration cost. Because they don't, uptime is not the concern that it might be with other platforms.
Right.
The other thing is, beyond that, I mean, if you're looking at it from an ORM interface perspective, you have such sort of a narrow view of the database. And I have to admit that I'm not that familiar with the Rails ORM.
Mm-hmm.
I'm familiar with some of its pathological behaviors because I've had to troubleshoot those.
Right.
But that gives me a very narrow view of how the ORM works.
Mm-hmm.
More where you really would get an advantage out of Postgres is if you have something where it actually makes sense to bypass the ORM selectively.
Right.
And directly access database functionality for things. Now, if the Rails ORM actually supported, say, extensible data types, then there would be a lot more reasons,
right?
To use Postgres, but I don't believe at present that it does. I believe if you have an odd data type, you get it back as a text string and have to parse it on the client side.
Yeah, generally,
I'm not absolutely sure of that. Yeah.
But it would be interesting now that you've mentioned it to see exactly where an ORM could go if it took advantage of some of these other features, you know, where you have the H store, for example, you know, where you effectively, you know, glue a dictionary or a hash on the end of your object, or used it for a specific field, or, you know, all kinds of things like that you've brought up that, you know, it would be really interesting to see how you could extend Active Record to touch those and work with those.
Yeah. Well, and like one of the things that we're actually working with now, one of the things that we're working on for 9.2, unfortunately, so you're talking about 2012 before it's out, but is actually having full JSON support.
I think,
and so then that gives you the opportunity to pass an entire object into Postgres.
Right. And I think I was talking to Ryan Smith over at Heroku, and he mentioned something like that it was kind of a beta feature or something, and that also sounds very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, it's been worked on for like, at this point, a year and a half, and the main delay has become competing JSON libraries. It took us a little bit to actually argue out the dependencies in order to figure out the rest of it and actually go ahead with the project. The reason that it didn't get into the current version, the new version, which is going to be released probably in September, is because effectively we had three different versions of the feature and couldn't reconcile them.
Right.
Which does happen in the Postgres world. But I mean, even right now, it would be really nice to see more drivers, including, you know, the Ruby driver, actually supporting, say, directly pulling arrays and dictionaries and other composite data structures out of Postgres, because obviously there's a huge advantage to it from a programming perspective. We're going to say, okay, I have this list, you know, and I want to store it. So rather than decomposing it somehow or serializing it, let's just shove it through the driver and shove it directly into Postgres. And that way, if I want to get item three of the list, I can actually ask for item three of the list out of the database.
Right.
Rather than needing to pull the entire list out of the database.
Yeah, that would be really handy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'd love to see more of that. The big problem is that when in ORM development you start straying away from supporting the lowest common denominator,
right?
Then what happens is you start having entire database dependent sort of trees attached for each database. And then at a certain point, you end up with features of the platform that are only supported on specific databases. So I understand the struggle that the platform developers are in with that. On the other hand, you know, if the feature is really, really useful. Now, one option is, and I don't know, I end up working a lot with Django. And I with the Postgres driver, it's fairly easy in your Python code to extend it to support additional data types. And it seems like, at least on a theoretical basis, that should be even easier to do in Ruby.
Yeah, theoretically it should be, because Ruby supports the open classes. So you should be able to just extend or add on to what's already there and add the functionality in without too much trouble.
Yeah, so...
In fact,
you know, I mean, really, I don't. I'm trying to remember who's maintaining the Postgres Ruby driver right now. I mean, because that really comes down to database drivers in a lot of ways.
I'm kind of curious myself. Let me see if we can find it here real quick.
Yeah.
Let's see. Developers. On Ruby Forge, it says Michael Granger, Ben Blything, and Jeff Davis are the project admins.
Okay. Yeah, and I think that's actually why we're not seeing as much of this, because I'm going to give you an example for Jeff. Jeff basically did a bunch of patches to the Ruby driver last year. But he's primarily a C programmer. He's not primarily primarily a user of the Ruby driver.
Right.
I think one of the things that we could use to really support Ruby and Rails developers better would be if somebody who really had a vision for where Ruby Postgres support should go would actually, you know, sort of take over the driver development and carry it forward.
Right. Yeah, the other interesting thing, though, is that, there are a couple of approaches that could be taken with this. One is that instead of maybe modifying the current driver, which kind of does just support, I don't know what all it supports, but you could actually create another gem that just extends the functionality itself, because you do have the open classes, and so you can get away with, basically monkey patching the current classes to add that functionality in. And then the other option is just to, you could just fork it and then, you know, send some pull requests back and see if they're willing to take the modifications. And I would assume that as long as you don't modify the current API that Rails and some of these other libraries depend on, you should be okay adding the new functionality to it. And then from there, you can actually then add extensions to Active Record in the same way that would allow you to access these data types in whatever manner you would like. But I think it would really be an interesting thing to see where these things go and how people use them. But yeah. I don't know who would do such a thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I that's the real question is. I mean, because it needs to be somebody who loves both Ruby and Postgres.
Right.
Because, you know, as much as I'm interested in seeing that happen, professionally, you know, on the application side, I mostly use Python and Perl. Right. Because that's what my clients happen to use. Mm-hmm. So I'm not the right person to do that.
Right.
The other big feature that I should mention on the end of it is actually larger data, as in blobs and clobs.
Mm-hmm.
Is also something that Postgres handles pretty seamlessly.
Okay.
In comparison to most other database systems, actually.
So what do you mean by
most other SQL database systems?
So what do you mean by pretty seamlessly?
In other words, for example, Postgres has one generic type for text called text.
Uh-huh.
And text will hold anything from one character to, I think the limit is 8K.
Okay.
No, actually, the limit's not 8K. Limit's 1 gigabyte. Sorry. So anywhere between one character and 1 gigabyte. And as a developer, you really don't have to worry about that. I mean, in the background, we're doing automated offline compression for larger text strings. Uh-huh. But that's not something that, from the interface perspective, you even have to know about.
Right.
Same thing with binary data. You can use the sort of standard large object interface, which is part, you know, implements the SQL standard. But that's really awkward.
Uh-huh.
It's awkward to use. It's awkward to maintain. Instead, Postgres provides a data type called byte A, which is for binary data. And again, you can put one byte in there and you can put, you know, 100,000 bytes in there. And as a developer, the only thing you have to care about is the response time of pumping that much data across the network.
Right. Well, that sounds nice. That sounds really, really handy. I mean, I've kind of been lazy and just kind of stuck with what I started with. And, you know, it gets so confusing over, you know, text, long text, medium text, as well as the blobs, you know, as you're pulling that data in and out, you know, it's just, it's really hard to see how it's represented there, you know. And I guess if you know it's binary data, then you know it's going to look like gobbledygook when it comes out. But at the same time, you know, yeah, just the different sizing and things, that would also be really handy. Well, it's binary. End of story.
Right.
You know, just stick it in there.
Yeah. And that's been really nice. It's actually a result of people implementing some really bizarre things on top of Postgres. Like APC actually has a video monitoring solution that actually stores the video in a Postgres database.
Wow.
And they just did that because it was easy, pretty much. I'm a little curious as to how that's working out, because, mm-hmm. you know, if you do have a lot of really large binary data in a database, there are issues with backup.
Right.
But from the interface perspective, it's pretty seamless.
So I'm going to ask a couple more questions regarding, again, I'm going to, you know, go after MySQL, but I'm a little curious. Do you see people switching from Postgres to MySQL? And if so, why?
Okay. So the main two things, because like you asked me over the internet, what do people give up by switching to Postgres?
Uh-huh.
And I would say, in terms of things that people decide on, one of them is that MySQL has been commercially successful for longer than Postgres has.
Right.
So as a result, there's still broader vendor support than there is for Postgres.
Uh-huh.
So you'll find things where there are simply vendor tools for MySQL that don't exist for Postgres.
Mm-hmm.
That's changing pretty rapidly. But you know, it's still predominantly that. The biggest thing, and particularly for the audience of this podcast, would be widespread cheap hosting.
Right. That's true.
There's 1,000 hosting companies out there where you can get a MySQL database for $7 a month.
Yep.
And there are not really very many for Postgres.
Hmm.
We list, there are hosting companies for Postgres, but there aren't nearly as many of them. Mm-hmm. Part of that has to do with some implementation issues with Postgres that make it difficult to run it in a really overloaded hosting environment, in a generic way.
Right.
So that would be sort of the biggest thing. And then the second thing that you're going to run into with Rails in particular is just that Rails is designed to work out of the box with MySQL, and there are some things which work oddly with Postgres.
Mm-hmm.
That's again changing thanks to Heroku and other developers. Buried in the ORM stuff, there's even an API for stored procedures.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks to some of the porting for Postgres. But, you know, in terms of in terms of just even reading like the installation instructions in somebody's blog for installing a Rails application, it's going to be written generally around how to install with MySQL.
I'm going to stop you for a second. We're getting a lot of static on the line there. It's not happening when I'm talking, but it might be happening when you're talking. This does seem like a good place to stop, though. Is there anything else that you wanted to talk over that we didn't get to?
I'd like to mention
okay, hold on. I'm actually gonna hang up and call you right back.
Is that any better?
Yeah, a lot better. Gotta love Skype. Okay, what were you saying?
Okay, so two things. One is, we're a community project. We're a big and friendly community.
Uh-huh.
So if you're interested in using Postgres or trying Postgres and you run into trouble, you know, we have an IRC channel that's active 24 hours a day on Freenode. We've got a whole ton of mailing lists. If you're just starting with Postgres, try PGSQL Novice as a mailing list where you can get help. And you know, most of our community members like helping other people who are trying out Postgres.
Love you.
The second thing I'd like to mention is we have a conference coming up, Postgres Open, in Chicago, September 14th to 16th, and Heroku is one of the major sponsors of that. So they're going to be talking some about their platform and using Postgres with Rails. And then the third thing I want to mention is that we're going to have a new version coming out soon that has a ton of new features in it. Mm-hmm. Actually, 9 major features. And
what are those features?
Going over it really quickly, because this would be a long call going over it in detail. So per column collations, synchronous replication, a transaction control feature called SSI for synchronized snapshots, which really it's a huge benefit mainly for financial and distributed applications, but it's a brand new thing, no other SQL database has it. K-nearest neighbor indexing, which is going to drive a lot of applications, particularly geographic applications, in the future. Integration with SE Linux for highly secure databases. And I don't have them all in front of me. there's a couple of others. But take a look.
Is there a changelog out there somewhere?
Yeah, there is. And if you actually Google for PostgreSQL 9.1 beta, you'll get the write-up of the beta that has a list of the features. You know, we release a new version every year, which I think we're the only major database more than a few years old that does that. And every version has several, if not multiple, major features in it.
Interesting. So what are you looking at adding in for maybe 9.2 other than the JSON?
So 9.2 JSON, more improvements to replication, because the binary replication was new last year. And so there's still lots of improvements to be made on it. One of the big ones, which is this has been a big thing that the MySQL people have ribbed us about, index only queries. So queries that only hit the index and not the base table. This has been a Postgres to do for a long time. So implementing that, it makes a big difference in performance if you have a query that, like, for example, if all you're looking up is the ID in a column.
Right.
It's really nice to not have to hit the base table because the index is much smaller.
Right.
Those are the things that I actually know and here's more importantly, a major performance improvement on machines with 32 cores and more. In terms of allowing us to, if we get everything in that realm to work, and keep in mind these patches are very new, if we get that all to work, then we've pushed the sort of good scalability picture of Postgres up to somewhere in the realm of 128, 256 cores.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah.
All right. So finally, I just want to ask, as far as getting people involved, if you want to learn about Postgres, what are the best ways to do that? Are there books? Is there a wiki?
The primary documentation is actually very good. It's a little weak in the sort of tutorial getting started department, but it's like 2,800 pages of documentation. So everything you could want to know about Postgres is in there somewhere. The problem is finding it. There are a couple of books out there. The basic sort of introductory books, like the one by A-Press, which I think is beginning PostgreSQL 8, is a little bit dated.
Okay.
But I mean, it'll still give you the basics. And the other thing is to actually ask questions from the community. So join the mailing list, join the IRC channel, join a local user group if you happen to be somewhere where there is a user group, and there's a bunch of those, and ask questions. People are happy to answer them, you know, and particularly happy to direct you to where you can find more information about things.
All right. And finally, if somebody wants to hire you or get your help on a project, what's the best way for them to do that?
So pgexperts.com is our website, and you can get in contact with me through pgexperts.com. And if for some reason we can't help you, there's a lot of other PostgreSQL companies and consultants, because we are a multi-company project, that we can refer you to.
All right. Sounds terrific. Well, thanks again for coming onto the podcast. This is kind of a deviation from what I usually do, because I usually just, I'm lazy and I just reach out to the people I know in the Ruby community. But I'm trying to get more projects, especially some of these open source or community projects that a lot of people are out there and using. So I really appreciate you coming on and talking about it and for your input. And hopefully people can make a better informed decision as far as which database engine works best for them.
Yeah, well, thank you for reaching out to me. Thank you for inviting me. This is fun.
Yeah, no problem. We'll hopefully talk later. I'm kind of curious about data warehousing, so we might have to have you come back on in a month or so and talk about that.
Oh, I'd be happy to. Thanks.
All right. Thank you. All right. I want to thank Josh again for coming onto the show. It was a super show. Just great, great stuff. We went over quite a bit of material related to databases and stuff, and honestly, I learned a ton, and I'm going to have to listen to this one again just to pick up all of the great, great stuff that's there. I do want to point out that you can get the show notes at teachmediacode.com. You can also find us in iTunes, and I do appreciate any reviews that you can leave, good or bad. I do check those on occasion and try and make sure that we are meeting your expectations and things like that. I want to thank New Relic for sponsoring the podcast. And finally, again, I want to remind you to go sign up for the mailing list. You can do that at teachmediacode.com. I've got a few things coming down the pike that I want to keep you informed of. And so if you want to go check that out, go ahead and do that, teachmediacode.com. I'm also going to be getting an episode up of the screencast. And last week there was a pretty good screencast put out by Eric Berry on putting a like or plus one button into your app. So if that's something that you're interested in, by all means, go watch that. It's a pretty good follow-up to the episode I did on putting a star rating system in. So if you have any questions or if you have any work related to that that you want to send my way, then by all means, you can call me at 801-367-6164, or you can email me, chuck@teachmediacode.com. And I would just love to get in touch. One other thing, I'm going to be putting out a survey. I said this last week, but then I never did it. I'm going to be putting out a survey because I want to know who you are and what you're interested in, as well as just get an idea of who the audience is. So you can go fill out the survey. I also appreciate any emails just on who you are, what you're up to, anything that I can help you with if you have questions about Ruby or Rails. And anyway, so we'll just go ahead and end it here. If you want to contact me, those are the ways to do it. And we'll catch you next week. Remember, writing the code is the easy part.